I want to thank Robert and Peter for the invitation. This is a subject that isn't a very cheerful one, I'm afraid. And the tone, I have to warn you, is going to be somber. If this were a political rally, I guess I would be obliged at the end to give us a glimmer of hope and to suggest some direction we can move on. I don't know that there is a real hopeful resolution of the current situation we're in vis-a-vis the worsening relationships between the world's two major nuclear powers. And I don't know what I would even advocate people to do. Being informed and informing others, of course, is an obligation. In the long run, how successful that will be, we'll find out. The title is rather wordy as you can see. But I felt obliged, first of all, to address either three distinct but interrelated topics or three aspects of one topic. I prefer the second interpretation. I think what we're talking about is one phenomenon. It has an international perspective. It has a bilateral dynamic between the U.S. and Russia. And it most certainly has a lingering, and I'm afraid, if anything, intensifying domestic component, which is to say this, that the Russophobia, the anti-Russian hysteria, there is no other expression for it, to be quite frank. If you've seen even in recent days or after Tulsi Gabbard and the second round of the Democratic presidential candidates' debates, you know, managed to critique Kamala Harris fairly successfully. Harris's press aide the very next day, I believe, or shortly thereafter, basically referred to Russian bots and Tulsi Gabbard's words being either provided to her by the Russians or exploited by the Russians. And I want to put capital "the" in the Russians, because unlike the Cold War, and I'm looking at our audience, all of us have lived through the Cold War. We know that what we're seeing is not really new. It's something that's been rebranded and intensified and exacerbated. That to be precise, for 102 years, there's been an undercurrent of Russophobia. It may have been from 1917 onwards, the time of the Bolshevik Revolution. It may have been anti-communist on the surface, but it was decidedly Russophobia underneath. And I'm afraid it's that component of the Cold War campaign or crusade that has sunk in deeply into the collective psyche or subconscious of people in most of the West, in the United States in particular. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, to eradicate. What I believe we've seen over the last 3 years, and I want to stress, in my opinion, that I think this simply coincides with the Trump phenomenon rather than being inextricably connected with it. And I would even suggest at some point that I believe that Trump's lack of popularity with half the population is being exploited to exacerbate tensions with Russia as much as Russophobia is being used to tarnish Trump and his administration. And I'll address that issue in a moment. But three things are occurring simultaneously, and I think the chronology is very important. If the accusing everyone and his brother and sister of being a Russian asset, witting or otherwise, was directly correlated with the Trump campaign of 3 years ago and his administration subsequently, then the other issues, the intensification of anti-Russian sentiment, and as I address as a third factor in this discussion, the historically unprecedented and dangerous breakdown of really 50 to 60 years of missile treaties and nuclear weapons treaties, that the Russophobia really begins in earnest on or about the time that Vladimir Putin, it seems the eternal head of state of Russia, made what I consider to be a comparatively innocuous speech at the Munich Security Conference in 2007, where, as I recollect, he doesn't even mention the United States by name, but he talks about the dangers of a unipolar world order and such like. He seems never to have been forgiven for those comments, as comparatively mild, I believe, as they were. Of course, at that time, because the political landscape was a little bit different, he was immediately attacked by the John McCains of the world. We have now seen arguably a reversal in terms of the U.S. two-party system, where the Russophobia, which had been most pronounced amongst Republicans, has now shifted almost entirely to the Democratic Party. So we've seen an intensification of exacerbation of U.S.-Russian relations pretty steadily for the last 12 years. And I would say that this has been much like the Cold War, you know, the bipolar world with the U.S. and the Soviet Union, where this conflict was fought out in proxy situations. So it would be everything from the coup d'etat in Venezuela, you know, early in the century, to you know, threats of war against Iran. They're all coming back to the surface again now. The 11 years ago, almost to the day, the four-day war in the South Caucasus between Russia and Georgia. There have been a series of these proxy conflicts where states allied to Russia, Venezuela, Iran, South Ossetia, and so forth, have been under pressure from the United States. And you've seen an indirect conflict, again, evocative of the Cold War period, where as often as not, American Bush wars were fought to, you know, ostensibly to ward off Soviet influence. Much more so than Chinese, by the way, we have to recollect. During the Cold War, particularly since the rapprochement between Mao Zedong and Nixon, Kissinger and Zhou Enlai in 1972, and it was never Chinese influence we were fighting, it was Soviet influence we were fighting. We all, are old enough to recollect the peculiar terminology that was used by the United States during the Cold War, where the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, comprised of 15 different ethnic federal republics, and literally dozens, if not scores, of autonomous ethnic republics, was inevitably referred to as Russia. Huh? Now, when those 15 federal republics all are independent nations, and there actually is a Russia, strictly, we're seeing a resurfacing of Soviet-era terminology to describe Russia. As often as not, you'll hear TV news anchors, particularly on the cable stations, slip up and use terms like Soviet. It's not unusual to this day to hear people refer to the KGB, which has not existed for 28 years, right? Recently, I mean, this is, and there's going to be some humor, I would hope, because of the sheer absurdity of some of the things I'm going to be repeating. But if it's humorous, it's in the sense of the words attributed to Voltaire, that God is the director of a comedy at which we dare not laugh. Because absurd or surreal as it may be, it's not really at root, it's not very funny. So what we have is, in recent days, Mitch McConnell now has acquired the moniker Moscow Mitch. Lindsey Graham, of all people, has been referred to you know, on social media as Leningrad Lindsey. I mean, this is one of the worst war hawks, one of the most decidedly and vehemently anti-Russian characters at that. As soon as he says something that offends, you know, the Democratic Party and its allies, now becomes a Russian agent. I want to, first of all, because I don't arrogate to myself, you know, any privy information that isn't available from a number of very insightful and courageous people who have spoken out on this issue. I'm going to mention just, this is not a completely inclusive list, but I think it hits most of the important people. Max Blumenthal, Stephen Cohen, Noam Chomsky, Jimmy Dore, the comedian in Chicago, who I recommend strongly, Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, Diana Johnstone, whom Dale and I were speaking about, Daniel Azair at Consortium News, Stephen Lenman in Chicago, Aaron Maté, Young and As Good As They Get, Ray McGovern from Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, Tim Poole from Chicago, a content creator on YouTube, David Stockman, Ronald Reagan's former budget director. He has changed a lot in the interim. Matt Taibbi at Rolling Stone, and Michael Tracy, amongst others, who have been, as I say, very bold and very courageous on this. I'm sure they've lost a lot of friends, and I'm sure they've received a lot of threats, because this is such an inflammatory and sensitive issue. In terms of the villains, we're not only talking about the leadership of the Democratic Party, we're talking about the never-Trumpers, you know, within the Republican Party, the late and thoroughly unlamented John McCain, you know, the Bush family, and others who you know, have never abandoned their Russophobia because they have no opportunist reason to do so. I mean, I think we're safe in assuming that the majority of Republicans who have abandoned their Russophobia have done so under motivated strictly by partisan political reasons. Their party is under fire for being you know, on the Trump is a Russian puppet accusation, so they are, I think, understandably trying to you know, combat that accusation. The fear that I have is that we're not getting this from the editorials offices of the New York Times or the Washington Post exclusively. This Russophobia is being spread by social media extensively. It's also being done, I mean, everyone knows the Tokyo Rose, if you will, of the Russian conspiracy theory is, par excellence is Rachel Maddow at MSNBC, who almost nightly for years is developed every sort of grotesque and maniacal Russian conspiracy theory. I recall seeing her on YouTube several months ago where she was reporting, as though she's a weatherman or a climatologist, that there was record cold temperatures in Fargo, North Dakota, and then says, imagine if the Russians cut off heat. This is one of those sardonic laughs I told you these comments would evoke. We also, though, all have to say that late night comedians who have become really the political spokespeople now for most Americans. I wonder how many people really listen to the cable televisions as opposed to how many people pour their third glass of wine, light up a reefer, and listen to the likes of Bill Maher and Stephen Colbert. Colbert is unrelenting. Anyone who watches him knows this. It's almost nightly where he goes into Russian diatribes, anti-Russian diatribes. They are, sickeningly in my opinion, racist, xenophobic, homophobic. He and his crew and a good deal of the Russophobes. It's no surprise to any of you, if you've watched anything on television or the internet the last 3 years, there are actually great big billboards around the country with Vladimir Putin, where Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump are portrayed kissing passionately. There are any number of them even more graphic in homosexual relations. Apparently homophobia is perfectly all right if it's aimed at the right people. This is really appalling. Similarly, the xenophobia. While criticizing Trump rightly for three of the five deplorable categories, if you recollect, are xenophobia, racism, and homophobia, and the Russophobes are exploiting three of those to beat the band. I'm going to read you a couple statements that you may be familiar with, and I'm going to use language that I ordinarily wouldn't use, but I think we need to hear the original language. Former National Intelligence Director James Clapper, as you probably know, several months ago, made a statement that, I want to get this precisely, where he said, there's rather an embarrassment of riches with this information, I'm trying to reduce them to order. Clapper said that the Russians are almost genetically driven. Russians, qua Russians, right? We're not talking about the Russian government. We're not talking about the Vladimir Putin administration. We're not talking about Russian intelligence services. The Russians are almost genetically driven. I'll try to find the exact quote. I'll have it in a moment. In the meantime, though, I want to the phone conversations and text messaging between Lisa Page and Peter Strzok at the FBI, keeping in mind that Strzok was in charge of FBI counterintelligence operations and basically launched the Russia collusion conspiracy investigation, right? These are excerpts, if you haven't heard them, in communication between him and his lover, Lisa Page. Page says, I do always hate the Russians. It is my opinion that with respect to Western ideals and who it is and what it is we stand for as Americans, Russia poses the most dangerous threat to that Russia, not Putin, not the Kremlin, Russia poses the most dangerous threat to that way of life. The conversation goes on. Strzok texted Page, the cheating mother Russians, bastards. I hate them. I think they're probably the worst conniving, cheating savages. Now I invite any savages. I invite anyone in this in this group today to suggest if that comment had been made publicly or privately and then revealed publicly about any other ethnic group in this on this planet, whether there would not have been a far more passionate, nobody seems to be concerned about that except myself. Their language goes on. This I don't want to get into too many of the details, so I'm ready to talk about them in the question and answer period, about the actual details of the accusation of Russian collusion conspiracy. But amongst this tortuous, labyrinthine series of things about Putin's niece, Russian consulate in Miami, what are some of the others? Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen, going to Prague. Putin doesn't have a niece. There is no Russian consulate in Miami. And Michael Cohen said, at least under sworn testimony in Congress, that he's never been to Prague. So, but to the Russian conspiracy theorist, don't let the facts get in the way. There is one theory, of course, that the Russian intelligence services somehow tapped into the DNC server and released information through some mysterious entity in Romania called Guccifer 2.0. According to Hillary Clinton, there's also a Macedonian connection. So I don't know if they can find any more obscure countries in the world to, you know, pull into this international nexus. Maybe Palau, Liechtenstein. But anyways, the discussion goes on between Page and Strzok. Page says, I want to find the Guccifer, sleazy Romanian, Strzok wrote. Page responds, they all are. Strzok says, funny to watch and think of, it's redacted. No wonder, so forth, those Romanians aren't even the gypsies. That is, they're so bad, they're presumably even worse than the gypsies, or the gypsies are so bad and the Romanians are no better. You know, no racism here, of course, right? And then they go on. Seriously, I kind of hate them, but they have the Romanians. But they have the crookedness of the Russians with the entitledness of the Italians, Page answers. Page goes on, and this is, I'll wrap it up here. These are people working for the FBI, one of whom is in charge of initiating the Russian collusion investigation. They don't recuse themselves. There's no conflict of interest here. They have no bias, right? Page goes on about the Russians. Russians, all of them, she says, I hate them. I think they're probably the worst. Very little I find redeeming about this. Even in history, couple of good writers and artists, I guess, probably the worst. I defy anyone to think of a statement made by an entire ethnic group or a nationality like that that would pass muster. And by the way, these people consider themselves liberals and enlightened. Remember, this is the same Peter Strzok who I could smell the Trump voters in a Walmart. These are liberal elite people who can use language like that. The Clapper statement, which you should hear in its entirety, is the Russians, almost genetically driven to co-opt, penetrate, gain favor, whatever, which is a typical Russian technique. This is, you know, pretty much what we're dealing with now. We're dealing with pretty close to half the adult population of the United States, which rationally, irrationally, consciously, unconsciously, or some combination of all of them, has been won over to the campaign that the Russians are evil, racially inferior, genetically driven, uncultured, filthy animals, even worse than Romanians, Gypsies, and Italians. And this is proper discourse now amongst not backwoods Republicans, but amongst the most educated and, by their own definition at least, the most enlightened people in the country. That is a very dangerous precedent. This is far more dangerous than the Cold War in that respect. Keeping in mind also, for ideological reasons, during the Cold War there always had to be a distinction drawn between the Communist Party and the Soviet the Russian people. The Russians were good, their government was bad. Now, as you can see, they're all lumped in the same category. We don't make any distinction. They're just evil and driven to co-op and penetrate and do nasty, rotten things because they're not really fully human, I guess, is the assumption. This goes on day after day. To the degree it's sickening. I would suggest an experiment. Go to YouTube when you have the opportunity. Go to any of the network or cable TV program, ABC, NBC, CBS, MSNBC, CNN, anything other than Fox for, partisan political reasons. And view look at the listeners' comments. View the listeners' comments beneath. You will see hundreds, one after another. You type in the word Russia, of course. You'll see hundreds, one after another, attacking Russia, attacking the Russians, attacking anyone who doesn't attack the Russians. I mean, this is something out of Arthur Miller's The Crucible, right? Today's witch hunters, tomorrow are going to be the witches. And we've seen it where, as ludicrous as I mentioned, that Lindsey Graham, can actually be referred to as Leningrad Lindsey. And I don't know how humorous that's meant to be, but if it's humorous today, it won't be tomorrow. If anyone gets in somebody's way, they're going to be accused of being a Russian agent. So that's the internal situation. One can argue, then, is the Russia collusion theory, which I think we all sensible people would have to say, not only the release of the Mueller report in March, but the you know, his appearance before the House committee a couple of weeks ago, I think thoroughly puts the rest any reasonable claim that the any Russian entity, government or otherwise, successfully intervened in the U.S. election. Now, as for the hacking of the DNC emails, it still needs to be proven that any of this, even assuming all of it is true, influenced a single vote one way or the other, right? Or influenced any state with its electoral votes being shifted from what would have been the Clinton to the Trump column because of the interference of you know, external factors. Somebody by the name of Dr. Robert Epstein, an American psychologist in England, I saw on YouTube the other day suggesting that YouTube search result manipulations, by his estimate, could have swung between 2.4 and 10.6 million votes to Hillary Clinton. I can't, you know, establish whether that's true or not, but let's put that on one side of the scales and weigh what, you know, $46,000 worth of Facebook ads, many of them after the election, were likely to have had in determining the election in you know, November of 2016. Now, as to the press campaign about the Russian collusion conspiracy, and I'm using both words because in the Mueller report, I haven't read it, but I'm familiar with aspects of it, the words at times are used interchangeably. When Mueller is asked if collusion means conspiracy, he says no, but in the report that, if you watched his testimony, by the way, he seemed to be woefully unfamiliar with the report that bears his name. But there were at least intimations in the report that this the collusion, if it existed, was tantamount to conspiracy. Conspiracy means treason. Treason is a capital offense in the United States. Anyone convicted on that charge could be executed. So we're talking you know, pretty dangerous stuff. After the Mueller report, redacted, as you know, was released in March, the heroic, in my opinion, Glenn Greenwald was on Democracy Now! And he referred to the entire situation as follows, and it's one of the better statements I've heard, by the way. And I'm quoting him word for word. He says, this whole Russian conspiracy debacle or charade is the saddest media spectacle I've ever seen since I first began practicing journalism in 2005. He then quotes the Rolling Stones' Matt Taibbi saying, what this was, oh no, I'm sorry, I want to finish with Greenwald, who also threw in, this whole thing was a scam and a fraud. He then quotes Taibbi saying, this is worse than the Iraq war media distraction. And this has been, you know, the Judith Miller, you know, controversy in the New York Times and so forth, where we were stampeded, you know, into panicking and war with Iraq. A similar statement has been made by you know, other people, other comment. Jonathan Turley is one of them, if I can get to it real quickly, who says basically the same thing. This is comparable to the lead up to the war against Iraq, you know, late 2002, early 2003. Does that mean quite literally that this is a lead up to war? I sincerely hope not. But I think there is enough resemblance. I mean, you don't poison the well. You don't poison the atmosphere as thoroughly as we have. You don't create a near panic level of hysteria and so forth, unless you plan to tap that and use it for some reason other than getting Donald Trump out of the White House. About which, and I don't think this is rarely addressed, if all adequately in my estimate, the reason that you know, half the political establishment, more than half the political establishment, because it also means the, you know, the so-called country club Republicans or the never Trumper Republicans. We have to recollect it was none other than John McCain who delivered the infamous Steele dossier, salacious and unverified, in the words of the FBI head. It was John McCain who delivered that to Comey at the FBI, right? So this was a dossier commissioned by the Hillary campaign and the Democratic National Committee, brought in an MI6 agent. The document is then delivered by the person who ran against Obama not too many years ago to the FBI to be used to deep six the campaign of the Republican nominee, Donald Trump. So we, I think, have to realize why the Russia conspiracy theory has been so central over the last 3 years. And my interpretation is this, that to effectively impeach Donald Trump, I'm not a lawyer, but I think this is something we all probably recall from the Clinton and the Nixon cases. Somebody has to be guilty of a crime or an infraction while serving in office. I certainly would not be surprised to know Mr. Trump is guilty of prosecutable offenses for activities prior to his coming into the White House. But the only way of getting him out of the White House, barring direct reason to impeach him for something he's done, is to simply invalidate the election. And the Russian conspiracy theory has the appeal it does, I suspect, to traditional Republicans and the entire Democratic Party establishment, exactly because it nullifies the election. If the Russians swung the election and cheated Hillary Clinton, then Hillary Clinton really won the election. Trump not only should be removed from office, he should have his name removed from the history books. He was never legitimately president of the United States. And I think that's why it's had this hold. Even before he was inaugurated, Frank Rich, late of the New York Times, now with, had an article in roughly December of 2016. And by the way, I mean, we've been around the block a few times politically. There are things in newspapers of record like that you don't say unless you're pretty safe, you're pretty sure you're covered. And he made a statement in December of 2016 to the effect that Donald Trump is going to die in prison for treason. I don't want to be melodramatic about this, and I don't want to bring up, genre fiction or espionage books or something, but it's almost like you don't say that about a sitting president unless you know for a fact he's going down. And I think, somewhere along the line, there was probably a supposition, and it would be a correct one in my estimate, that there was enough support within the Republican Party hierarchy, especially in the House of Lords, right, in the Senate, that if Democrats could regain control of the House in 2018, there would be enough Republicans ready to vote for conviction in the Senate. I think that had to be the game plan. But at any rate, against that now, what do we see also? We see Rachel Maddow, and anyone who didn't see this, please look it up on YouTube. While a few months ago it appeared as though John Bolton was going to have his fantasy realized and there was going to be military action against Venezuela, Rachel Maddow on MSNBC gets up and says, with a picture of Bolton in the background, no matter what we thought of him in the past, we really have to applaud his firm position vis-a-vis Venezuela. This is remarkable. Now, I can translate that for you. Venezuela is a Russian ally. Russia is bad. We destroy Russia's allies. John Bolton is our friend and ally. I mean, that's how I translate it, and I don't think it's any more sophisticated than that, right? So that means a lot of nasty people now become our allies. Let's recall the days leading up to the infamous John McCain's funeral, where established liberal publications were condemning Trump's insensitivity to this great American war hero. When George H.W. Bush died, liberal and even seemingly progressive people, look how rude he is to this great American war hero during World War II and head of the CIA. Boy, isn't that patriotic? And president and the monster who created Operation Desert Storm. So it's gone so bad that what we're seeing is the resurrection of Cold War zealots into being, in many ways, heroes to people who consider themselves liberal or even leftist. There are two books published. By the way, there's a veritable industry of Russian collusion books. Go to Amazon, just look, Russian collusion. There'll be dozens. I mean, this is a gold mine for certain people. But two books were published on both ends of this debate recently. And I want to focus just on the titles. One is Stephen Cohen. Russian studies professor at Princeton, on the editorial board of The Nation. And his book is called, let the title sink in, War with Russia? From Putin and Ukraine to Trump and Russiagate. Another book was published by Michael Isikoff. You'll recall his name. He's the chief investigative journalist with Yahoo News. He's been around the block also with major publication, major news establishment news publications. He wrote an article in Yahoo News in connection with the release of the Steele dossier. The FBI then used his article to corroborate the Steele dossier. I mean, this is a real shell game. He co-wrote with David Korn of Mother Jones a book, the title is Russian Roulette, the Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. I should mention, just show, when Hannah Arendt, talking about the Nuremberg trials, referred to the banality of evil, this is an example of it. To use a tired, cliched, threadbare expression like Russian roulette, and then I'm sorry I can't show it to you, as you might expect, on the cover, the first R in Russian is reversed so that it looks, in the word Russian, to represent the Russian character that is pronounced Ya. I mean, this is getting to the level of comic book, but it's but there's something very dangerous behind it all. Yesterday, I was looking through YouTube, and there's a major Russian mainstream television news program called Vestia News, or Vesti, actually. And the topic was NATO leak 150 nuclear bombs on Russia's borders. We can dispute whether that's true or not. I wasn't able to establish where they found the leak. But one of the moderators of the show, after a discussion of several issues around this line, asked the following question to all the people on the panel. Should we launch a preemptive strike? About 2.5 weeks ago, Dmitry Symes, who was a major think tank analyst, Russian-born, had an article I saw in Yahoo News, by the way, and the title was "Are Russia and America Headed Towards Nuclear War?" and it was an interview with a Russian military expert. I don't think this is hyperbole. I don't believe people are using language. Stephen Cohen is most assuredly not using language like this because he wants to incite a conflict between the United States and Russia. Several months ago, the infamous Max Boot of Council of Foreign Relations, also Russian-born, Soviet-born, was on a TV program, Anderson Cooper's, I recollect, with Stephen Cohen. And Cohen is, a distinguished scholar. And he mentions in passing that he's been a Russian scholar for 40 years, and Boot says, and a Russian agent for 40 years. This is the depth. I mean, I swear to you, I mean, I paid a lot of attention during the McCarthy period. I mean, I was born during the McCarthy period, but during the Cold War, I don't remember anything of this order. The other thing I want to say, and I'm going to get a bit personal about this, you see my last name. I lived through the Cold War. My paternal grandfather was born in Russia. According to his wife, my grandmother, a kind of fraternal Russian-American organization he was a member of, was raided by the FBI while she was present. They padlocked it and so forth. I just learned recently that she, though born in the United States, had married my grandfather, who was born in Russia. And my grandfather became an American citizen, but because of the infamous Mitchell-Palmer raids in 1919 and this reign of terror that came down on immigrants, because of the Russian Revolution, that she lost her American citizenship. And she, born in the United States, had to reapply for American citizenship because she had married a legal immigrant. So this is, the sort of backdrop you have to look at, how deeply, anyone of Russian descent feels this. This is from Jonathan Turley, who's a pretty mainstream journalist. Hope I can find the exact thing. Because there was something discussed in the Senate, introduced by the Democrats, needless to say. And I'll come up with the exact name, but it was an initiative by senators of the Democratic Party to investigate anyone involved in the 2016 election or politics in general in the United States who is a Russian national, has moved here from Russia, or who is of Russian descent. It says specifically parents or grandparents who came from Russia. This would, by the way, as somebody pointed out, would include Bernie Sanders. Amongst the people accused of being Russian agents or acting as Russian agents, Jill Stein. I mentioned Mitch McConnell and so forth. Other people have been Tulsi Gabbard. I can remember when Rand Paul, libertarian, Tea Party libertarian, senator, got up a couple of years ago in the Senate and said about NATO, which had just inducted its 29th member, Montenegro, 600,000 people, which seems to exist for no other reason than cigarette smuggling and allowing Russian oligarchs to buy up seafront property. I mean, seriously. When Rand Paul rhetorically says, is it worth initiating World War III to defend Montenegro under NATO's Article 5 Mutual Defense Clause, John McCain gets up and says, you are a Russian agent. So this is what we're dealing with. Now, in 2002, the George W. Bush administration withdrew the United States from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the ABM Treaty. You may know on August the 3rd, the Trump administration withdrew the United States from the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which had been initiated by Reagan and Gorbachev in the 80s. With the buildup now of new technology, including nuclear cruise missiles, other missiles that kind of blur the distinction. There are four gradations, by the way, of ranges of missiles. They're short range, medium range, intermediate range, there's a difference, and long range. The IBM Treaty, International Ballistic Missile Treaty, is also coming up very shortly. And that speculation is will also go the way of the other two treaties. In February of 2021, the New START Treaty, Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, it comes up, and it looks like that will be scrapped. Additionally, there's even talk about the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty being disbanded or being ended. About which, this Russian program I mentioned to you, Vesti, they mentioned the fact that, aside from the leak, that there are 150 U.S. nuclear weapons on Russia's borders, what is incontestable is that there are five countries in Europe that have U.S. B-61 nuclear gravity bombs. They are Turkey, Italy, Germany, the Netherlands, and Belgium. Turkeys are housed at the Incirlik Air Base, which is dangerously close to Russia. As was mentioned on this Russian show, the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, amongst factors determining the use of nuclear weapons, is they're to be staged, they're to be based only in the host country, right? There's no provision by which one country can move nuclear weapons around the world, but the U.S. has routinely done that. The second thing is that part of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was that was the initial step that was supposed to lead to the eventual elimination of nuclear weapons as a whole. There's no discussion of that anymore. So we're living in a situation where three things are occurring simultaneously. We're seeing globally a worsening of the crisis between U.S. and Russia. Keep in mind, these are the two countries who, with the New START Treaty, still have 1,500 nuclear weapons actively based, ready to go, deployed, ready to go. They're the... No, I think it's down to 1,500. Yeah, but I mean, they have arsenals of, considerably more, which could be activated, so that's a good point. They're the only two countries with a triad of delivery systems, long-range bombers, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, ground-based ballistic missiles. So an exacerbation between tensions between those two countries, of course, takes on peculiar significance. As dangerous as the current Kashmir crisis is, and it is, this would be the most immediate threat of a nuclear conflict I think we've seen ever, excepting Nagasaki and Hiroshima as not being so much a conflict, but the use of nuclear weapons. But in this situation to exacerbate proxy and other conflicts, by the way, I didn't even mention Syria, right? The Russophobia by extension, again, a la the Cold War, it's not just that Russia is inherently evil, but anyone who has good state-to-state relations with Russia is also an enemy that needs to be destroyed. You might remember when the Trump administration launched 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles into Syria, that anchorman newscaster Brian Downey showed photographs you know, in the Eastern Mediterranean, them being launched from destroyers, and said, beautiful, beautiful, twice. And because he had just died, I think, shortly before, he quotes a line from a song by Leonard Cohen. What a beautiful sight, Tomahawk cruise missiles being fired into a defenseless country, no? So we now see that a lot of the justification for hostilities against Venezuela and Iran, Syria, and anyone else, either are manifestations of the Russophobia, or can be justified as saying, yeah, this is a way of getting back at Russia, you know, through their proxies. This is, again, you know, very similar to what happened in the Cold War, but there was a comment by a NATO official recently. I don't know, I'm going to back a couple steps. Three years ago, maybe more, somebody put out a map. It was very interesting. And they showed basically Eurasia, and they showed current Russia, post-Soviet Russia. And then they showed all the NATO countries bordering it. During the Cold War, there was only a narrow strip of Norway that connected NATO to Russia. In 2004, seven Eastern European countries are inducted into NATO at the same time. Three of them former Soviet republics, and all but one of them former Warsaw Pact members. Four countries at one time join NATO that border Russia: Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, right? Since that period, exactly in 2004, 2005, there's something called NATO air policing going out in the Balkans, in the Baltics. And they're up to 12 sophisticated warplanes from NATO countries. Just the other day, one of them, a Spanish F-16, buzzed the airplane of the Russian defense minister, Sergei Shoigu. This is pretty dangerous stuff, right? And this isn't happening, you know, off the New York Harbor. This is happening in St. Lawrence Seaway. This is happening, miles off the Russian border in the Baltic Sea. So that, this map I was alluding to showed all the military bases, right? There are eight major military bases in Bulgaria and Romania that the U.S. and NATO have taken over. There are major military bases in Poland. There are military installations in Azerbaijan and Georgia on Russia's southern border. They've expanded NATO presence in Turkey to include a X-band radar that takes for missile defense radar that takes in almost all of Russia and so forth. And the map shows all this buildup, and it says, look at the nasty Russians, how they move their country so close to NATO bases. But I actually saw a statement. I mean, this wasn't even ironic. On the NATO website that says we're increasingly concerned about Russia moving hardware near to NATO countries. And they talked about the Kaliningrad exclave, right, part of Russia. That how dare the Russians move missiles, Kaliningrad borders Lithuania and Poland, right? The question is not why Lithuania and Poland are in NATO. It's why Russia would dare to bring certain types of, you know, of missiles into their territory, now bordering NATO territory. So we've got all that going on simultaneously. We have any number of flashpoints, and it doesn't take, you know, an F-16 to buzz the defense minister's plane to touch off something ugly. Anything could erupt in Ukraine tomorrow again. This has been a simmering war that's gone on for 4.5 years. It could be something again in the Caucasus. It could be, you know, any number of things could occur that could trigger conflict. And the Trump administration, let's not fool ourselves, right? Or rather, let's not be fooled by, you know, the Russophobes who have played this off as though he is somehow a puppet of Russia. It was astonishing. The real beginning of this thing, in my opinion, is during one of the debates, you know, in 2016 between Clinton and Trump. And as I recollect, Trump says in so many words, Vladimir Putin to Clinton doesn't respect you, he won't fear you. Now, I read that, and you tell me what you think about it, as you're not strong enough vis-a-vis Russia, or you're indecisive or feckless or whatever it happens to be, I'll be strong. I mean, that's hardly a pro-Russian statement. It's at that point where she says, and if you get elected, they'll have a puppet. Huh? He, since he's come in, not only did he launch 59 cruise missiles into Syria and probably kill some Russian nationals into the bargain, I'm sure, not only has he shaken down NATO for an additional $1 billion worth of pledges from European NATO allies to meet their 2% requirement under NATO conditions, but when his now Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, then acting CIA director, when he, during the confirmation hearings for his becoming Secretary of State, gets up, I saw it on YouTube, and says, we killed several hundred Russians in Syria. That's a quote. We killed hundreds of Russians in Syria. The report was up to 300 Russian contracted employees killed. If that's pro-Russian, I really hesitate to see, you know, what an anti-Russian would look like. So I think we have to disabuse ourselves of the idea that he's been blackmailed because he paid prostitutes to urinate on a bed, or that he wanted to set up a casino in, you know, Kharkov. I don't know what these theories are meant to establish, but I think we can clearly look at the record, and there's no reason to believe. I mean, he has been much more bellicose towards both Iran and Venezuela, Russian allies. He's increased U.S. military presence on the ground in Syria. You know, there was a very negligible number under the Obama administration, and they weren't even always open to acknowledge to be there. So the claim that, you know, he's soft on Russia, if not a Russian agent or puppet or what have you, is simply belied by the facts. I mean, the facts don't establish that, and quite the opposite, in my opinion. I want to bring up, though, something that's, because up until now I've been pretty much speaking about the established elites and their mouthpieces in the United States, you know, the leadership of the Republican and Democratic parties, and their, you know, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, New York Times, and cable and network television. But in early this year, the U.S. House passed a resolution, House Resolution 676, called the NATO Support Act. And this I find particularly troublesome, and I'd be remiss if I didn't raise this issue, because it tends to suggest to me how far this thing has spread. The bill is, I think, unprecedented. I know of nothing like it. It states, and I'll read you some of the excerpts. NATO is described, this is, you know, the military bloc that now has 77 members and partners, over a third of the countries in the world, that has waged war in three different continents, in Europe, Africa, and Asia, that recently has inducted, most recently since the Chicago summit of NATO in 2012, has brought in 9 new countries under a program called Partners Across the Globe. These are Mongolia, that borders both Russia and China, Kazakhstan, that borders both Russia and China, is a long-term NATO partner, actually an advanced partnership program. The other partners across the globe include South Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, and most recently, Colombia. So NATO now has a partner in South America, in fact, has a partner in every continent except Antarctica. This organization is referred to in House Resolution 676 as a pillar of international peace and stability. It is described as one of the most successful military alliances in history. It promotes a Europe that is whole, free, and at peace. And anyone who hasn't heard that phrase, Europe, whole, free, and at peace, was originally introduced by George H.W. Bush in 1989 in Mainz, Germany, in a speech of that title. You know, the ruling elite and the military-industrial complex signal each other oftentimes, like street gangs do, and they're morally and otherwise not, you know, too far removed. By using certain catchphrases, that's one of them. Do a web search sometime in that expression, Europe whole and free, Europe whole, free, and at peace. But it originates in 1989 from Bush. It predated the reunification of Germany, which is what he's foreseeing, the expansion of NATO towards the Russian border simply by the incorporation of the former German Democratic Republic, and led up to, of course, eventually its you know, NATO expansion and all that. But this House resolution uses that buzz phrase. Pay attention next time you hear it. It then says, you know, this resolution, that our irresponsible European NATO allies must pay their 2% of gross domestic product into the military. It demands that they do that. They're shaking them down, like Trump shook them down, right? It also says, particularly, and this is where it gets to the crux of the issue, it is in this sense that the Congress demands that, quote, the president shall not withdraw the United States from NATO. Who in God's name believes that the president wants to withdraw the U.S. from NATO? Right, the one who went to their summit last year in Warsaw? The one who shook down his allies for another $1 billion? But the Democrats are concerned that Trump is going to withdraw the United States from NATO. They also talk about something called the European Deterrence Initiative. And here's the exact quote from the resolution. It is meant to deter and defend against Russian aggression. It then appends a statement from the last NATO summit That states Russia must withdraw its troops from Moldova, Ukraine, and Georgia. By Moldova, they mean Transdniester. And by Georgia, they mean Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and Crimea is Crimea. This is more complex than really justifies my getting into it, but we have to recollect that certain political entities, I mentioned earlier autonomous republics in the former Soviet Union, right? An autonomous republic was a republic within a federal republic. And this makes perfect sense within the Soviet context, but made no sense prior to the Soviet context and makes absolutely no sense post-Soviet Union. So that when the Soviet Union began to break up, even before it is formally dissolved, certain of these entities fought not to be incorporated into an independent Georgia or Moldova and so forth. So, but this is what this resolution says. It is insightful. I mean, CITE, insightful. It is one of the more offensive statements of the Russian general staff, I suspect, saying something like that. The vote was passed with only 22 no votes. The 22 were all Republican. Amongst the people who voted for them, to her great credit, Tulsi Gabbard either abstained or wasn't present. Amongst the people who voted for it, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley, Chicago's own Jesus Garcia. I'm mentioning these people because I think people would have expected better from them. I don't know how in heaven's name they can justify voting for this. This is one of the first House votes that came up after they entered the Congress. I know Jesus Garcia, or I knew him, and I can't tell you how hurt I am that he would sign on to something like that for whatever reason. I know the excuse will be this was to stick it to Trump, but surely there are other ways of doing it. I'm going to wrap it up on this basis. Aaron Matei, who, if you don't watch him, he writes, but he also has a YouTube station called Gray Zone. He's recently spoken, he said, with all the reasons people could have gone out in the street and protested decisions made by the current administration, why is it the only time they really came out, anyone really came out in force over the last couple of years, was when Jeff Sessions resigned a few months ago. And mass demonstrations occurred in 30 or 40 cities the very next day, with expensive professional signs, with, in some cases, people out there with lyrics to popular songs reworked on the Mueller investigation. I remember one that ended in the refrain, Putin's whore. I mentioned this to Robert earlier, and I want to find the exact comments, because this suggests that, we're up against something a lot bigger than just the establishment parties. When Jeff Sessions resigned or was asked or was forced to resign, Anna Gallant, who was the executive director of Move On, set up an initiative called Trump is Not Above the Law, and supposedly to protect the Mueller investigation, because we all knew he was going to come up with proof definitive that Trump and everyone he's ever met were working for the KGB, based in Leningrad, and so forth. And what the website said was, Trump is not above the law, rapid response events. And she said that 400,000 contacts have been notified in 900 cities to come out. That is a mass mobilization, in my opinion, unprecedented since those against the war in Iraq. I can think, and maybe the Women's March would be the only other one I could think of those dimensions. I looked at some of the videotapes from the marches in various cities. Some of the signs said, Joe McCarthy, where are you now that we need you? One of them said, treason, espionage, traitor. One said, burn in the USSR. One said, people power, not Putin power. I remember seeing a sign of somebody looking like a rock guitarist, and he had the orange yellow pompadour that is Trump, and playing off the Bruce Springsteen song that said "Born in the USSR." So I want to tell you just how nasty this has become, and how deeply ingrained in people's thinking and emotions, even more than thinking, the Russophobia has become, and that this thing is not simply limited to, and I would argue, is really not primarily the result of this is a nice way of getting Trump. I think that is part of this. I think there's a lot of political opportunism, and when I mentioned the five freshman Congress people I did earlier, I would have to guess that their inspiration was anything you can use to get Trump, and if that means building up a military alliance that has waged wars of aggression against defenseless countries in three different continents, well, that's fine, right? There's a Latin expression that says, fiat justitia pereat mundus, let justice be done though the world ends, perishes. I fear that there are people, not only within the Democratic Party, there are people who would consider themselves to be progressives and leftists and so forth, who, in order to bring down Trump, would, like Samson, bring down the pillars on the entire temple. And I would caution us to be very concerned about that and to urge people to step back from this. Because the end result is, with the cancellation of major missile treaties, with the increased tension between Russia and the United States, this thing could rapidly get out of hand. And we could go from Russophobia aimed at Trump to being exploited by some other force, including the current administration, to eventually use that animosity towards Russia to build up the drums for some kind of dangerous confrontation, the results of which potentially are something we don't even want to consider. Thanks very much.
That was a rather chilling presentation, I have to say, as much as I think I've ever heard. One of the things that has really troubled me is that, like, it's almost, where is there anything whatsoever coming out? And I analyze from the standpoint of, like, getting into the heads of these, like, the Rachel Maddows. I mean, what do they see? I mean, I'm at a loss because it's kind of the old thing. Remember what they used to talk about, Herman Kahn? Remember on thermonuclear war? I don't know if you remember the title. We had this notion about MAD, mutual assured destruction. Whatever happened to any and all of this? These used to be part of that discussion. And it's like, we're not there anymore. We have gone mad for all practical purposes. I'll leave it at that. You
can address that point. That play on words is going to be very difficult to follow up on. No, your point is well taken. In the course of discussing, the issues, and they're important issues, economic and social and climate and so forth, we tend to lose perspective or focus on these things. And this current Kashmir crisis, trust me, this is dangerous beyond comprehension. A couple days ago, I think 10 soldiers on both sides of the line of control were killed, Pakistani and Indian. And it was understood, I think, with all the treaties we're talking about, starting with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the ICBM Treaty, was that the U.S. and the then Soviet Union, and Russia now is a successor state to the Soviet Union, had a particular responsibility, as they were the ones who brought this monster into the world, that not only must they disarm, but they must lead an international effort to stop the proliferation of nuclear weapons and to bring about the destruction of those that exist, as earlier mentioned. The fact that this subject has been off the table for the last couple of decades, I think that, look, I cannot characterize it otherwise than as this way. When the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, I think we all just said, okay, now we can all go home, no threat, peace has come on the world, we're in the age of Aquarius, and so forth, right? The exact opposite happened. The U.S. and company, this is a unipolar world that Putin had the audacity to remark, is that that led to an increased recklessness and adventurism around the world because there was no counterbalance. I think that was predictable, right? But unfortunately, we can't even agree on something as simple as, abolishing weapons in countries that are in a state of hot war right now, currently, right, like Pakistan and India.
We'll all remember that right after World War II, NATO was formed with two principles in mind. One was to push the Soviet Union back to its own borders, and the second was to create military units in each NATO country that would be able to put down uprisings or revolutions in other countries so that the native military wouldn't have to put down their own people. And with the dissolution of NATO, we're throwing Europe into the Soviet Union, into Russia's hands, and leaving us with no frontier buffer. It's gone.
Right. Right. No, you've raised several good points, and I'll be brief in my response because I know Peter wants to say something. George W. Bush, you know, after the NATO summit in 2004, where, as I mentioned, you know, seven countries all in Eastern Europe joined NATO at the same time. At the end of the Cold War, 1991, there were only 16 members of NATO. 10 years, they started inducting new members, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic in 1999. By a decade later, they've got 12 new members. That's a 75% increase in NATO in 10 years. And, you know, a couple of small Balkans countries, Montenegro came in, Macedonia will come in next because the name change has been affected, right? But what that means is, and George W. Bush, shortly after that 2004 summit, said words to the effect that, he was sitting president at the time, the Warsaw Pact has now become NATO, in fact, right? I mean, the entire Warsaw Pact, minus Russia now, is now part of NATO, and they've moved the border. Now, this, and thanks for catching me on this earlier, Peter, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty is so vital because, while there was a Warsaw Pact, there were several hundred miles of buffer zone between U.S. military hardware and personnel, say, in West Germany and Russia. Now there is no buffer. So if you, INF treaty covers, I think, 500 to 5,000 kilometers. So now if you have a U.S. nuclear tip cruise missile in Poland or Lithuania, it hits I was going to say Leningrad because of this current thing, it hits St. Petersburg or Moscow within like 5-10 minutes. I mean, this is all dangerous. You know, there is no buffer, as you said. And I think that's critically important right now. That's why it's more dangerous.
No time for anyone in the Soviet Union to decide whether this is for real or not. The stakes are far higher than when people were afraid that, you know, I might go out and I might get killed by an Islamic terrorist. On how important it is to be able to point at someone and say that they're Russian, like it was important 60, 70 years ago. And with that, I guess I'll have to stop.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. First of all, for raising a very interesting question about the arms race, and I was negligent in not mentioning that. We have to know that Russia has 155 million people. We have 330, 340. They're a small and shrinking country. Their military budget in U.S. dollars is about $60 billion a year. It's been going down. Our new National Defense Authorization Act budgets $733 billion for next year. That is more than 12 times what Russia spends. So there's no equivalence here. They're not a military threat to us by any stretch of the imagination. I think that's important to realize. The other thing is, I did want to mention, because it's become repeatedly cited by Stephen Cohen again, that he characterizes it by saying the current situation and the worsening of U.S.-Russia relations is worse than the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I think by common consensus, of a common accord rather, was the most dangerous period probably in human history. This is worse, he says, and he's not alone in saying it. There's a quote from a magazine article by two people you wouldn't expect to hear it from, by the way, former Senator Sam Nunn and former Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, who state that this is a quote from recently, with the withdrawal of the U.S. and Russia from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, it says, have put the nuclear threat at its highest since the Cuban Missile Crisis, and stating the following. This is a quote for these two. The United States and Russia are now in a state of strategic instability. An accident or mishap could set off a cataclysm. Not since the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis has the risk of a direct confrontation involving the use of nuclear weapons been as high as it is now. And the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientist, you may know earlier this year, moved the doomsday clock to 2 minutes before midnight, which is the highest, I mean, the most dangerous it's ever been.
A couple of points for you to address. William Appleman Williams, in his Making of American Imperialism, addresses the long-standing, going back to the 1800s, animosity towards Russia's wealth, even under the Tsar, and its inaccessibility to U.S. capital, predating the revolution, and U.S. interests in gaining access to it. William Binney, the former NASA scientist, has scientifically proven that the emails of Hillary Clinton were not hacked from overseas. That information is offered to the U.S. press repeatedly and ignored for them to publish and test if they wanted to get to the facts. The last point is that Vladimir Putin, in a number of public statements, has referred to their understanding of what the U.S. is doing, making war in the Middle East, attacking countries that are unable to resist, and referred to the U.S. indirectly as the wolf at the door, that they understood and they would resist. They took themselves off no first use in the last couple of years and have explained that because of the proximity of the missiles and the war college talk about usable nuclear weapons, the technological development of the scalable nuclear weapons and steerable nuclear weapons, B-21 gravity bomb?
B-61.
That Boeing is helping to create. Nuclear war could be green with their deep penetration. And they talk about, at the war colleges, the ability to decapitate Russia, decapitate the leadership. Everybody else in the country would welcome Americans with open arms. I wonder if you might address some of that. It is dangerous, and we're likely to be caught off guard as a result of the American press being totally at the beck and call of the financial class.
You know, there are several missile weapons programs, and these go back really to the George W. Bush administration. So again, as mentioned before, this is incremental strategic military buildup for, and I'm glad Dale alluded to it, for a potential deep strike, first strike military attack against Russia, China, and Iran. Those are the three countries that are clearly targeted by things like prompt global strike, hypersonic missiles, space planes, Star Wars or Space War, the so-called anti-ballistic missile system and so forth. I don't have time to go into all of these, but they're being developed at the same time. I might mention as a little bit of vanity that a decade ago I wrote a fairly extensive article about prompt global strike that Fidel Castro, in the goodness of his heart, decided to pick up and republish, you know, with his commentary. He, at least, I think, you know, saw what that meant, because along the lines of what Dale was saying, if you can develop deep penetrating super stealthy planes that can go right into the interior of Russia and China undetected, and if you can fire the prompt global strike, which is allowing the U.S. to deliver a missile strike within 60 minutes to any point on the Earth, to go down to less than a minute, according to military officials that, you know, I've seen cited to that effect, then what it does is this. It, what Peter was saying, it puts the tripwire so delicate that anytime you see something on the radar screen, if you're smart, you're going to hit back because you fear there's a second round of missiles coming if you don't knock them out. What I'm particularly concerned about, though, in Eastern Europe, and I'll be brief on this, is that starting in 2009, the George W. Bush administration was going to put missiles in Romania and a missile radar site in the Czech Republic. It was what's called a ground-based mid-course missile intercept. The Obama administration, Hillary Clinton, switched that to what's called the European phase adaptive approach. That's why they're ballistic missiles in Romania now, and next year going to be in Poland. There is no, I mean, does Russia trust them that these are simply, in the user terminology, kinetic hit to kill missiles with no payload on them? You know, before or after Moscow was wiped off the face of the map? You know, at what point do you trust that this is simply what they stated is and so forth? So this is a level of danger we're talking about. New weapon systems, instantaneous. Cyber warfare and space warfare alone should terrify us, because what that permits the U.S. and its allies to do is this absolutely close down, you know, communication control, computer, and so forth, networks for the military of another country, rendering that country absolutely, in the computer age, defenseless. I should, you know, suggest in Huntsville, Alabama, where Von Braun was, with the U.S. Missile Defense Agency, it's been reported, this years ago, that if you go into the director's office, there's a reproduction of Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative speech So all this talk about the missiles going on Russia's border not being Star Wars, not being this is exactly what it is, and they acknowledge it to be so. This is the son of Star Wars.
Okay, well, thank you.